Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest this week is novelist Vanessa Veselka, author of The Great Offshore Grounds, out now from Knopf. I almost said out now from Knopf. Anyway, sorry. It's been a trying week here in the Pacific Northwest, and that's why I'm especially grateful for this opportunity to talk with a great American novelist who lives right here in Portland, Oregon. The Great Offshore Grounds, which opens, quote, 15 miles south of Seattle and halfway across Puget Sound to the west, end quote, is a great, great big book. An inclusive and uncompromising cross-country story that questions the nature and implications of identity and reinvention, of personal history and national mythology, of blood and chosen family. There's a big cast of characters, big parties, big weather, big themes, nothing short of capital, freedom, and the American dream. This is a book I'd recommend to pretty much anyone and everyone. As our reviewer writes, quote, Veselka takes a kitchen sink approach to the novel. Points of view shift kaleidoscopically. Passages of history and politics are woven into the quest-like narratives of the characters. The result is a fiery and occasionally luminous chaos that feels true to the experiences of those for whom each day is lived at the edges of mainstream society, end quote. Vanessa Veselka is the author of another novel, Zazen, which won the Penn Bingham Prize. That's for debut fiction. Her short stories have appeared in Tin House and Ziziva, her nonfiction in GQ and The Atlantic, among others. And her official bio states, quote, she has been at various times a teenage runaway, a sex worker, a union organizer, an independent record label owner, a train hopper, a waitress, and a mother, end quote. I honestly can't wait for this conversation, but first a word from one of our sponsors for this episode, Amazon Crossing, about the memoir A Drop of Midnight by Jason Diakite. Born to interracial American parents in Sweden, Jason Diakite grew up between worlds. Part Swedish, American, Black, White, Cherokee, Slovak, and German, riding a delicate cultural and racial divide. It was a no-man's land that left him in constant search of self. Even after his hip-hop career took off, Jason fought to unify a complex system of family roots that branched across continents, ethnicities, classes, and eras to find a sense of belonging. What he found was a story only he can tell. Read or listen to Jason Diakite's moving memoir, A Drop of Midnight, for free with Amazon Prime. Visit amazon.com/adropofmidnight. And now, let's talk with Vanessa Veselka, author of The Great Offshore Grounds. Welcome, Vanessa, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, before we get to road trips and tall ships, this novel, among many things, and I'm personally of the opinion that a novel should be many things, three novels stapled together, for example. Yeah. It's an idea I picked up many years ago from interviewing the novelist Wilton Barnhart.
Oh.
But anyway, this novel, The Great Offshore Grounds, is, among other things, the story of two sisters named Livy and Cheyenne. I took this little paragraph from the book that I'd like to read. As girls, they'd been fed a fairy tale. Two women loved the same man. One wanted a baby, and the other wanted to chase the North Star. Each became pregnant, so they made a plan. The one who wanted the baby would take both children, and the one who wanted the North Star would continue on. The first mother was happy, and the second mother was happy. Okay. So there's that fairy tale, that myth of origin of these two characters. They're in their 30s at the beginning of the novel, en route to the wedding of their father. More on him later, maybe. He has something to give them. He's rich, so they think it might be money. Turns out it's the name and last known address of the mother who didn't raise them. And he's like, you're welcome.
And then Cheyenne and Livy have to figure out what to do with this bequest. Am I missing anything else for an entree to the novel?
No, okay. That's about right. Okay. I guess the only other thing I'd add is that they don't know which sister is connected to which mother.
Right, which is a fascinating conceit. And to me, as somebody who's a East Coast native who lives in Portland, Oregon, it seems like an entirely possible thing here in the gloomy Pacific Northwest. So one of the ideas here is that this book is dealing with is that of history, both American history, global history, the history of our species, personal histories, the history we're given and the history we claim. So the question is, can you make up your own history? Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Or can you free yourself from the one that you've inherited?
Right. So why was this a concept you wanted to explore?
Well, it emerged naturally in the book. Mm-hmm. There was an initial, the way I started the book was I free wrote dialogue. Mm. I just came, and that's often how I start almost everything, is I just randomly throw out a question, and it's not one I've thought about. It's just something that catches. In my first novel, it was, can you sit still on fire? And then the response was obviously, no, you can't. It's biological. And then it ensues a debate, and in that debate emerges characters with conflicting viewpoints, and that's how I start to know them. So in this, you know, there was one of the questions that is not in the book, but that came up in the first, you know, few lines was, don't you wish you were born before it was all falling apart? Mm. And this question of, you know, everything sort of disintegrating around you in terms of the promises of the world that, you know, generations before seem to have been raised with. But and the question of, is there a freedom in that, and where do you stand in history? I think these are characters who, while they don't obsess on history, know that they're kind of trapped by it by virtue of being Americans in many ways. You know, that the you are both on stolen land, you are built on slave labor, and at the same time, there's possibilities too, and how do you reconcile these things, and possibilities for whom, and can you free yourself from this history, and how much do you have to carry with you, and how much do you get to reinvent?
Right.
And I think that question of reinvention is really tricky because it's a very American thing, right? Like, I've lived in other places. I've traveled a lot. It is a very American thing to just wholly reinvent yourself.
Right.
And to drop into subcultures. And it's been done beautifully and it's been done horrifically. And it is an aspect of privilege, but it's also an aspect of the wideness and wildness of the country, which is still there.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Reinvention. Was this novel reinvented? And if so, how many times?
No, and probably this is why it takes me a long time to write. I'm very stubborn, and when I get locked on something, my approach is these are the limits, and I must figure it out within these limits. I almost never come back and say, oh, that's not really the novel. I fight to the death.
Yeah.
And in this case, that involved also moving publishers and editors and agents and, you know, walking into the wilderness a bit with really no idea whether or not I was going to find a publisher. So I'm very stubborn that way. Everything that I let go of has claw marks on it. And so I need to work with people who can be in that debate with me, right. Not done well with people who are more of like, you know, I'm the authority and I know this and I know that, and you should listen to me.
Yeah.
I need an honest debate, and I really believe that the best idea should win. And I'm totally willing to be convinced, but I have to be convinced.
Right.
And so no, I didn't reinvent it very much, although I tried to make it better and better. And I did that with input of other people as well towards the end.
So where does the strength of that conviction come from? How did you learn to stand your own ground as an artist?
Oh, music in a lot of ways. But also, standing my own ground is a deep, deep trait of my character. And, you know, in very problematic ways at times, too. You know, I left home very early. And one of the propositions that you know, made so much sense to me was really simple, which was, you know, you can't live under my, you know, you can't live by my rules. You can't live under my roof. And to me, I was like, seems fair. Goodbye. You know?
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of 15-year-olds wouldn't have made that choice or taken it so literally as a reasonable proposition. So that plays into how I look at things. And then I was in music for a long time and I experienced trying to take in so much input about what was good or moving or better in one song or another that I ended up losing my sense of what I, you know, of where I wanted to write into in some ways. And I hated that. And so I've come to understand and believe that as artists, all we have is our work. Now, that may mean we don't have a career in it. And so to separate out, for me, the choice was, would I rather have my work or rather have my career? There's also a very different aesthetic and way of doing things in music. I'll tell you a quick story about Neil Young.
Yeah.
I don't want to, I sound like my kid. Can I cuss?
Yes, okay. You may.
Okay. Because it's in the line here. So Neil Young had this, he has this very particular sound. It's always for years was sort of, how do you do that? And there's all sorts of ways that he does it, but he had this special box that he would always play through. And it was an obsession of music nerds. And he was on a German television or a German radio or television show doing an interview. And they were asking him about the box and like how it worked. And he explained, well, the real trick of the box is not that it's, you know, is that it's actually literally turning the dials of the amp so that it's a natural breakup, which is the best sound, but hard to get because how do you get back to the amp and do it without fidgeting all the time? And so, especially if you only want it for a solo, right? So he had built this thing that literally physically turned, you know, sent a signal and turned the dialed the amp. And he explained it to this guy. And the guy wasn't quite getting it. He said, so do you have somebody back there who's turning the knobs? And without a beat, Neil Young just said, if anybody touched my fucking amp, I'd kill him. And you know, it's like, I have that idea that really native to music and really unfamiliar in the writing world.
Right.
There's a sense of like, everybody should tell me what's wrong with me in the writing world. And I have a little bit of that, if you touch my fucking amp, I'll kill you, in me. And I think that like, it's an interesting thing because in music, a lot of times people know what that means. That means, okay, maybe I don't have a career. And there are people who decide, no, that's not as important to me. And that's all valid too. You know,
yeah.
There are people who have I have a love of the reader, but I have a love of particular readers.
Yeah.
I'm looking for people to be in conversation with.
Right. Right. So I want to ask you a question, which is like for the real prose heads among us, like if you were to consider this novel as a machine, like could you nerd out about one of the prose mechanisms in here that you're proud of?
Huh. Well,
or is that too esoteric?
No, it's not esoteric. I'm just trying to think about really working with a third person voice was a problem. I think that when you come away from a novel that's first person or your first novel, I think there's this question that I've always had, like, how much do I get to take with me and how much belongs to that, you know?
Yeah.
And that sort of interrogation. And I found in my case, it was depressingly true that much of it belonged to the novel and the character, and I needed to move on. Third person does stuff that felt like a constriction in writing that I didn't love. And so I had to find my way of doing it. And I don't know that I found what I really wanted to do with it, but I would say that the way that history gets tied in was something I had to work on and balance. And I feel like it got to a place where it really worked. And there is some of that is a sonic tone switch. It's the question of, okay, this is nerdy. This is the question of pause.
Uh-huh.
You can't pause the way cinema does. And we're so formed by cinema. So cinema, you know, the camera holds on something and how long it holds tells 1,000 stories.
Right.
And it tells you and cues you as to what you're supposed to feel and whether this is a moment and how it happens. But you can't pause on the page, right? You can't slow it down. The reader's eye will go how the reader's eye goes. and they're going to turn the page or they're going to read the next paragraph, right? So the question of how do you create pause, which is also how do you create emphasis or how do you shift time? There are only, you can do a chapter break. You can do a double, double white space. You can do, but like shifts in tone are actually one of the ways that I've learned to do that is to shift tone. And then, so when I come into the historical sections, I would shift in tone, sentence length, and the way of rhythmic repetition. And then it will build in the center of that to get something more breathless, to start to move faster.
Yeah.
Because of the sonic nature. And then it will expend into a certain kind of rhythm again. And if you were to look through all of the book at all of the historical, sort of historical or place moments that come in that sort of bring that experience in, they all have that. So it's kind of, and when I was reading for the audiobook, I didn't read the audiobook, but I did record for the audiobook so they would understand how my rhythms went. One of the things the director said is, oh my God, you speed up and slow down all the time. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's the language. That's how I wrote it. And so they tried to get that feel in places, but that's something I got from music again, is this idea of tempo and pace and how you're moving and that you're not reading straight, but that like you'll get really breathless, you'll move fast, and then you're going to pause and you're going to slow and you're going to. So I think that's the sort of hidden nerdiness in those sections,
right?
That were making them work.
I'm loving it too, because now I have the image of a cassette tape, right? Whereas before, as just your basic layman reader coming into this, if I had been asked fresh off finishing reading this novel to describe the experience, it would have been one of zooming in and zooming out. In those historical sections were like more macro to me and pans and panoramic and then I would go in for like the detail work of the characters' individual lives in between.
Right. And I think one of the movements in the book in terms of its evolution was tying those things together. In the initial version, I think the historical narration functioned more like a narrator.
Right.
And was sort of put into a frame, but not completely connected in the most obvious way to the characters in action. And so that was one of the things that I really had to work on and resisted in some ways and had conflicts about.
Hmm. Your characters, so we've named Livy and Cheyenne. They have a brother, Essex. The mother who stayed is Kirsten. There are a ton of characters in this book. And these characters withhold a lot of important information from one another, like illness and assault and falling in love and big moves across the country and eureka moments. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk with you specifically a little bit about the intimacy of telling stories to people, deciding when to tell stories to people, who gets to hear it, and who gets to tell their own story to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my answer as a human is different than my the characters, than I would say the stance of the characters in it.
Right.
So which would you prefer first?
Human first.
Okay.
Please.
I think that we don't own our stories in the way that people think we do. I think there is there's a Tlingit concept, which I won't perfectly pronounce, but it's called at'o. It's a guttural stop, but I've heard people pronounce it different ways. But what it is it's story ownership. And my father was adopted into the Tlingit in 73. And so I also have a recognition through that I'm Kiksadi ID, Child of the Frog Clan, So anyway, it's so there is obviously a cultural tie to the Tlingit in a very limited sense in the way that I have great respect for, but don't own the story of. So the way that story ownership works is, with the way people think of, and it drives me nuts when people talk, and first of all, lump Native American cultures together.
Yeah.
Particularly when they're like, they didn't believe in land ownership. Well, fuck yeah, they did. You go meet the Tlingit. They're like Vikings. they not only believed you owned the territory, they believed you owned the constellation over your territory. They believed you owned every song, every story that was ever told about that place. Like, if it's not your story and it's not your dead, do not tell it. And so, things get lost that way too. So there's this crisis of, well, who's left to tell the story? And do you tell a story? What if you have been privileged to go into worlds that you were also privileged to leave, whether that's poverty, whether that's sex work, well, you know, whatever it is? How do you find your right to tell a story? And how do you balance that against all the complexities? So I feel that we, and particularly I see this and kind of rail against it, this idea of, well, it happened to me, therefore it's my story to tell.
Right.
At one level, that's true. And in another way, it's part of the insane self-serving individualism of, you know, figuring out what, you know, the thing that's destroyed the concept of collective anything.
Right.
It's my fight. You know, it's the sort of the so sue me attitude.
Ah, yeah.
And at the same time, there is something true. And so it comes out in the Battle of Sitka, which I reference in there mm-hmm. and wrote about elsewhere, but where they, the Tlingit themselves have to contend with this idea because, you know, it's a Kiksati story. So I was able to hear and be told parts of it that I don't tell, you know, as child of Kiksati, you know, but that's not, I don't tell those, right? Because it's not mine to pass that on in that way, but I've been told them. But the, in trying to figure out how to talk about the battle, they contended with the fact that like it didn't, the storytelling rights had it completely, if you follow them to the letter of the law, even within the Tlingit, you know, framework, it cut out the children of the Kiksati who would not have been Kiksati. It cut out, you know, I mean, it, like it, they contend themselves with this idea of like, how far does that go? So that story ownership idea is something I really am sensitive about and sensitive to and always struggle with in my writing and maybe too much at times. I wish I was somebody who felt more bravado about my ownership of my own stories because it would make my life a lot easier, but I don't think it would make me a better person necessarily, but who knows? I think for the characters, that question of who gets to tell the story.
Right.
Cheyenne definitely doesn't like the stories that are told about her, you know, and has been injured by other people's stories about her deeply. And at the same time, you know, she knows she's kind of a mess in a lot of ways, but she's been injured by those stories. Livy is just private. You know, she is just, you know, nothing comes out at all without a fight. Kirsten is more, she's always got a plan. She's trying to put on somebody. She's always got a theory of what should happen. You know, she's always got like a way of her thinking through what everybody's story is and myth, you know, and like, trying to like have them have these peak initiative experiences. And like, so her idea of story is very, very different. I would say Essex doesn't care about his story at all. He wants to have no story in some way because he has trouble directing his own. So I think also the thing is that by and large in the novel, people don't share the stories because they don't want the other people to worry about them. They want to save each other from the cost of how hard it is to live their lives in this way. And so they don't tell those stories.
Right. You know, because, you know, the few resources, you know, you might have left are emotional, you know, especially when you're taxed to the hilt, especially when fees and triplicate forms and 90-day waiting periods for your health insurance, you know, the last thing you can do is protect one another from the emotional impact of hard news.
Of hard news. And also the sort of, if this person, I know this person only has this, and if they hear I'm in this position, they'll give it to me and then they won't have it. You know, there is a very clear concern for each other's, the limited resources, emotional and physical and financial.
Right.
That each character has.
We are in community, and almost it's like, you know, the people are their own organism. My inroad to thinking about it this way is one thing among the many things you do well is a party scene. We get one right at the beginning. We got one in the middle. We have groups and gatherings, but like full-blown parties too. And like I get the sense through your language, especially in that first one, the father's wedding, of like those assembled, considered as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. Like the people that make up the group and the undulation of a crowd, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
I love writing party scenes. I did it in Zazen too.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, again, I would not say that writing Zazen or writing this was any great pleasure. But then I would hit some scenes and I was like, oh, I'm going to have fun with this. writing the sex party scene in Zazen was actually the most relieving fun thing I did. And then I think with this, there was something cathartic about writing the Joshua Tree party scene. Because I have been that character in some ways, where women are punished for their promiscuity or sort of brought in as free spirit pets and then completely eviscerated because they really don't belong. And in that sense of passing through and of loneliness and what you want out of the emotional world that you think you're getting in trade, but then turns out not to be, and nobody took it seriously. So writing that scene, I have a perverse pleasure in torturing my characters and like all their bad decisions and making it just like really roll out. I enjoy that. It's some of the most tragic things I have a sense of humor about. But I also felt like writing that scene, I was getting at something that I knew to be true and that I really wanted to put into a context where it could be understood. You know, she's very physical as a character. Her reaction to almost everything is, you know, she's not a, you know, there was something that was cut out of the book just because, you know, many things were over time, but where, you know, she was trying to get from one point A to point B and get back to live in Alaska. And initially I had her, you know, just have sex with some, you know, wannabe spiritual ponytail guy at, you know, Watt, Carolina, you know, and just sort of make the calculation right away. It's just like, you know what? Sleeping with somebody I don't want to sleep with, there's not much of a price to pay for that. I've done that before. You know? Sort of like I don't care. there is that kind of thing with her. And I'm interested in that idea as well as just like, you know, anyway.
I mean, I could talk to you all day, but I mean, I saved this big fat softball for you. So here's the pitch is, how do you feel about the phrase, the great American novel?
Oh, this is really funny and embarrassing, but when I got kicked out of school in my, I think I was 14 because I think I, no, I would have been 15. And I was, you know, a kid in some distress. I was cutting myself. I was doing a lot of things, you know, and I was sent for, you know, a week of mental and intellectual and otherwise assessment to see whether I needed to go to a lock-in facility. And it was in Cambridge. So they gave me batteries and batteries and batteries of tests, you know, and assessments and interviews and like, what do you write when you see this picture? And what do you, you know, it's where I found out my aptitude for maths, which I'd been failing regularly, were actually higher than my aptitudes for any kind of verbal skills.
Me too.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a variety of things, but when they called us in for the assessment, my mother and I, who were not speaking to Richard very well, you know, what they said is, we don't think that she needs to go to a lock-in. We think she could write the great American novel. And I remember thinking, why would anybody want to do that? All I cared about was music, you know, but I don't think I can ever say like, I could write the great American novel, but I think if you don't have some kind of grand fighting ambition that you want to try, then what are you doing? I mean, I know that that's totally different for many writers and that they approach the work with like, I'm just trying to tell a simple story, and that they make incredibly beautiful, meaningful things and perhaps get closer to writing the great American novel. But for me, it's that fight for the death. I remember explaining when I had to move, you know, publishers, editors, agents around this novel, having a conversation, and my agent was a very kind man, saying, you know, everybody's trying to help you do this project, this 19th century novel, to write this, you know, socially, or this robust social novel, and just to polish it more. And I said, oh, that's not what I'm looking for at all. That's not what I want. I understand the misunderstanding. I'm not trying to write a social novel, a robust social novel. I don't give a fuck about, you know, manners and real, you know, and I realized we had both been talking about 19th century novels, but we were talking about different 19th century novels, like totally different ones. I'm like, oh, no, that's not what I'm after at all. Suddenly, I know what the problem is here, you know? And I said, I am willing to let the failures of the novel show in the reach at something unattainable. And that was really, that's why I write. But it is also unattainable. And the failures will show. And emotionally taking that in, I'm not so great at. But I do believe that, you know, I'm going to die trying. It's going to be how it goes.
Maybe we need to reinvent the phrase. Maybe we need to redefine the great American novel. Maybe we have to change the definite article to an indefinite article, a great American novel. Because seriously, no bull. When I will forever, you know, like a word map, one of those constellations people make, you know, it says, you know, I say snacks all the time, whatever. I will associate the great offshore grounds with great American novel.
Oh, God. That's a very, very high praise.
I mean, you know, I'm giving it away for free today on Fully Booked.
I mean, I'm even happy to, like, take out the great and just say an American novel. Mm. You know, so much of the inception of this novel for me was, how can I love America? What do I love about America? What do I find unbearable about it? Like, where... You know, and all of those questions, which I think really, you know, come home in the epilogue. But yeah, so my attempt at heart was to write an American novel.
This novel helped me think about those things for myself. So I thank you. Yeah, I thank you for that. And the most hospitable question in my little bag of tricks is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the book before we go?
Oh, I'm just trying to live up to the cover.
This cover. You know,
I just have to say that cover was remarkable. And I felt when I went to Knopf, and they've been amazing at every level, every part of the people I've worked with have been all in and like personally behind the novel, like, and the care that went into really thinking through what the novel is about and trying to get both the tone and the gesture of it onto that cover was remarkably touching to me.
Would you give our listeners just a little sketch? Because maybe they don't see it.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it's an ocean of blue and green, an ocean that's churned up with a wave. Not like a tsunami wave, but like, in a trough. But it's seen through the broken up prism of a Fresnel lens, which is a lighthouse, you know, one of the old lighthouse lenses, which captures diffuse light and directs it. And is a Victorian creation. And so there's something very, and the sky is beautiful in it, but there's something that feels like deep tumult, but also like disorientation, and that draws the eye to the center of it in this very particular way. And I could never have found an image that evoked this sort of sense of something that I was after. You know, there is an uneasiness to being an American. There should be, you know, and there's all sorts of wildness in it too.
I can think of no better note to end on. Vanessa, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
No, thank you for having me. I'm very, very grateful for the support I've gotten, and I just hope that the novel finds its readers.
That was Vanessa Veselka, author of The Great Offshore Grounds, out now from Knopf. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books for the week. We have Young Readers editor Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Young Readers editor Vicki Smith is out of the office today. Starting with Laura, what's your choice for us?
So my choice for this week is The Cat I Never Named, a true story of love, war, and survival. And it's by Amra Sabich El-Rayes with Laura L. Sullivan. And it is just the most gripping, moving memoir. The author was a teenager in Bihać, Bosnia, during the Serbian bombardment and genocide. And she's Bosnian Muslim, and so understandably lived through, you know, incredible hardships, you know, starvation, death, near-death experiences, you know, seeing friends blown up, you know, just a few yards from where she was standing. It was just, you know, harrowing feelings of betrayal, you know, with her best friend was Serbian and evacuated and didn't say a word, you know, had been warned, but didn't say anything and left. And teachers who she trusted and adored, you know, let her down. So it was a very difficult few years. However, this little cat, Matsi, and Matsi means cat in Bosnian, and so that's why the cat she never named, showed up. And they believe Matsi had arrived with a refugee family and gotten lost. Anyway, became part of their family, even though, you know, wartime, they barely have enough to eat. Her mother didn't like the idea of an animal in the house. You know, it didn't seem like a great time to take in a pet, but there was Matsi, and she became not just this source of unconditional love for the family, which, you know, anyone who loves animals or has had a pet will understand this. She also actually saves their lives on multiple occasions. So it's this story about, you know, first love in the middle of war. You know, she has a crush on this boy. It's, you know, first love, enjoying school. She was this excellent student at the STEM school, and somehow the remaining students and teachers sort of pulled together, and just finding sort of family bonds and hope in the midst of everything feeling so bleak. And it's just this story that's also very timely, a reminder about how living in a multicultural, diverse society is not enough, that people can turn against one another. And it's really important to always be vigilant and aware of that, and to maintain an open mind, and for educators and parents, everyone, to just kind of speak openly about the importance of inclusivity and so on. It's just, I highly recommend it.
That sounds really good, Laura. It reminded me of a book that I read years ago, which was Zlata's Diary by Zlata Filipovic, who was, I think, 11 when the war started in Sarajevo. She lived there through the war, and she kept this diary. And then it was published right afterwards in like 93 or 94. So it was very immediate, you know, what happened to her as a child from the perspective of a child. So that might be a nice compliment.
Yes, I remember that one, and that would be a great read-alike. Absolutely.
Laura's pick this week is called The Cat I Never Named, A True Story of Love, War, and Survival by Amra Sabich El-Rayes, with Laura L. Sullivan. Thank you, Laura, for that pick. Next, we've got nonfiction with Eric. Eric, what's your book?
My book is called Agent Sonia. It's a new book by Ben McIntyre. It's about a female spy in Soviet Union, Ursula Kuczynski. She was one of their most successful spies, one of the most successful of the 20th century, in fact. And one of her main accomplishments was she had correspondence with a nuclear physicist, Klaus Fuchs. And so she was able to get scientific secrets that helped the Soviets develop an atomic bomb. So it's really in the kind of Ben McIntyre tradition. You know, he wrote Agent Zigzag, Double Cross, A Spy Among Friends. It's a really excellent, well-paced spy thriller. It's something that any Ben McIntyre fan will enjoy. And I know there are a lot out there. He's just one of those authors that's consistently good. And it's not just a good historical tale, but it's a really compassionate portrait of Agent Sonya. So I would highly recommend it.
And Eric, you can count me as one of those legions of Ben McIntyre fans, as you know.
So I
cannot wait to get my hands on this one. And in case anybody out there is not familiar with his work, I just wanted to say, I think the gift of McIntyre's writing is there's psychological insight and there's this real humanity to all the people he writes about. But there's also that, like you said, that pace of a spy thriller. So it's a really hard balance to get. Sometimes, you know, the action can sacrifice the human side, but he doesn't. And I would say Agent Zigzag and A Spy Among Friends are my favorites.
Yeah. I mean, and this, I think this one will be right up there. I'm glad you mentioned that because he's so very well attuned to kind of the psychological aspect. And, you know, it's a really good balance of that and the historical detail. He really gets into Agent Sonya's head. So
cool. Can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
The new one is called Agent Sonya, and it's by Ben McIntyre. Thank you, Eric, for that choice. And finally, we have Fiction with Lori. Lori, what have you chosen for us?
I would like to recommend What Are You Going Through by Sigrid Nunez. She has been writing for many years, but you might know her as the author of The Friend, which won the National Book Award in 2018. And this new book covers a lot of the same territories as that book. And I mean that in the best possible way, because what she writes about is the meaning of life, the purpose of friendship, the nature of death, writing, reading, you know, all the big topics. So in this book, the unnamed narrator spends the first half of the book just thinking about a lot of things. It's very episodic. She goes to hear an ex-lover give a talk at a college about a book he's written about sort of ecological doomsday coming up. Then she goes to visit a friend who's very ill. Then she thinks about a lot of different things. Then the friend gets in touch with her and tells her that she's dying. There's no hope. She's not, you know, she has cancer and there's no more treatment for her. And what she is planning to do is kill herself before she can suffer too much. And she wants the narrator to come live with her, get an Airbnb in a beautiful, isolated place, and just spend the last few weeks or month. She's not entirely sure when she wants to do this, but she just wants to have a pleasant time and have them enjoy each other and have a good time and just, you know, not have the narrator help her with her euthanasia, but just be there beforehand in case anything happens. So they go off and they talk a lot and they read books and they take hikes. And it's, you know, just thinking about all these really big topics. Nunez is a big reader and her books are always about a lot of other books. At the beginning of the book, when the narrator goes to visit her friend in the hospital and hear her ex-lover speak, she's staying in a hotel and she picks up this psychological thriller and Nunez describes it at great length, what's going on in the book, but then the narrator has to leave it behind when she checks out. And then she's staying in another hotel or maybe it's in the house, that the Airbnb that they're renting, the book just happens to be there again because it's a big bestseller. So she picks it up again and keeps telling you. So sort of threaded throughout this book, the narrator is telling you about another book. It's just very kind of funny and delightful. And, you know, for people, bibliophiles and readers, Nunez is such a beautiful writer. And if you haven't read her before, you'll be so glad to discover her. She has a backlist of lovely, smart, sharp, beautifully written books that you can read next.
Thank you for that, Lori. I am a fan of hers. And when I was reading the review of this book, it reminded me of one that's it's a little darker, but also quite funny. And that's My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Mosfidge from 2018. And I think it's, you know, again, it's not, it's this, The Mustache is much darker, but it's also funny with the narrator kind of staying in her apartment and taking a bunch of prescription medication and napping and thinking about all these different things. It's very existential. it seems like there's some similarities there.
Yeah, I think if you like My Year of Rest and Relaxation, you would like this book. It does have a similar insular quality.
Yeah.
And I did forget to mention that in spite of the fact that it's based around the suicide, there is a lot of humor in it. In fact, I interviewed Nunez for the magazine and I asked her about the humor and she says, you know, she always likes there to be humor in books. And even in Primo Levi's books about Auschwitz, she said, there's, you know, this warmth and humor, not like funny ha-ha jokes, but just a way of looking at the world that, you know, sees things that are funny.
Right.
So that's definitely there.
Laurie's pick this week is What Are You Going Through? It's by Sigrid Nunez. Thank you, Laurie, for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please tune in again next week when my guest will be Anne Helen Peterson, author of Can't Even: How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. And this is a book that grew out of her journalism for BuzzFeed. She is the author of How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, an article that ran January 2019 that now I think has had over 7 million views. And I think we all know why. We'll be getting into the nitty-gritty of it together next week. But until that time, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.